Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Modern historical narrative, this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations with the distinguished historian Lawrence Stone of Princeton University and Edwin Yoder, Jr., the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group. Because of the long shadows cast by World Wars I and II, as well as the Cold War, you might expect that military and diplomatic history would be central to any serious account of the 20th century. But according to Lawrence Stone, that isn't necessarily so. Lawrence Stone is at work on a study entitled A Nation-State at War, Britain in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. I asked him to reflect on what historians today are making of the outbreak of peace and civility the world has witnessed over the last few years, and to explain why he thinks warfare and diplomacy should be central concerns as contemporary historians render their accounts of the 20th century. Lawrence Stone.
Well, I suppose because war has been the natural pastime of man since the beginning, and you're a bit of an optimist to think peace is going to stay broken out, I may say so. But I got into it because I was interested in the effects of war on civil society. Mm-hmm. And I spent 5 years in the Navy myself, 5 years of my time has been taken up by that, and basically, my civilization, Western civilization, destroyed itself in two world wars in the 20th century. I think everybody would agree with to that.
After a fashion, Lawrence Stone, what we're talking about is the doing of history. That is to say, the way you historians look at the events of the past. Mm-hmm. Do you trace political events? Do you trace military events? Mm-hmm. That's what, do you call it, history from the top down. Mm-hmm. Then you've got history from the bottom up, where you're mm-hmm. looking at the lives of the neglected, as it mm-hmm. were, the mm-hmm. marginalized. How do you figure out the interplay between these two so that you are achieving an accurate picture?
Well, it seems to me what we social historians did for the last 30 years is ignore war entirely. This is an event and an accident and should never have happened and just a blip, and everything carried on as before. And
why is that? Why would you ignore something as important as the military?
Because we're dumb, that's why. We just made a mistake. I mean, it's perfectly clear.
But what forces brought that about? I mean, surely we're not talking a monolithic conspiratorial group decision amongst historians.
No,
here.
But it became very fashionable to say the only things that matter are economic and social factors uh-huh. and long-term trends, several centuries. And that small events of kings and battles and wars were trivial. Uh-huh. And we neglected this.
One of the preoccupations of historians, as I understand it, Lawrence Stone, is figuring out the word mentality looms mm-hmm. large. How not only did people live and what did they do and what happened on mm-hmm. a particular date, mm-hmm. but how they thought. Mm-hmm. Now, let me be politely impertinent. Isn't that really an impossibility to get into the minds of people who have been dead for all these hundreds of years?
I think it's very hard. And trouble is, we have a mess of prescriptive literature saying, this is the way you ought to behave, this is the way you ought to think, right. done by clergymen and so on, and various philosophers, etc. But what relation that is to what people actually did and actually thought mm-hmm. is another question. I think you can get at it, though. You can get at it through autobiographies, diaries, depositions in legal cases. That's probably the most fruitful thing in the last 20 years is depositions in legal cases. And of course, if you have a thing like the Inquisition around in your past, you're right. lucky.
And you lots really, of records.
Lots of records. Uh-huh. And if you have a sloppy, incompetent bureaucratic and administrative structure like England, you're in big trouble because, on the whole, people right. didn't record these things. The only exception was, however, the ecclesiastical courts. The church courts kept Roman law, and everything was written down. Uh-huh. They're an absolute goldmine.
What about the Napoleonic Wars, Lawrence Stone? Let's turn our conversation in that direction. That happens to be what you're working on and with here again in the late fall of mm-hmm. 1991. Why does that particularly engage you?
Well, let me backtrack a bit. I got into this mainly because I edited, am editing, a book of essays on Britain at War from 1689 to 1815 and the Battle of Waterloo.
That's a lot of wars.
Which is a lot of wars in that period, and some people have called it the Second Hundred Years' War with France, mm-hmm. ending in the final victory at Waterloo of the British. And it struck me that there's a paradox here that at 1689, English liberties were put in place. We had a decent constitution and a division of powers between the crown and the oligarchy, if you like. There was an oligarchy with a certain amount of voting potential for the middling sort, the middle classes. And that was, and English liberties were built into a Bill of Rights, and it was, in fact, a very decentralized state internally, with most of the administrative and legal procedures being carried out by amateurs on their own, with very little control from the central government, or not much. Against this, you have to set the paradox that this was the greatest war-making state in Europe, and it brought the greatest power, which had five times the population than England, i.e. France, to its knees in the end. How come? So, and the model we've been developing, it's not myself, but a lot of other people developing, is that the two are linked, that the key to power was money, not men, in the sense that all wars were international. Mm-hmm. Your army was part British, part French, part Dutch, part German, part everything. You just fished around the world and gathered troops from wherever you could get them.
All right, now you used the word model. I mean, to what degree does this, the scene that you have been discussing here, this interplay between the military in terms of manpower, the military in terms of finances, is that a model for what we have lived with, essentially, in what we call the modern world?
Yes, though I think that what began, and what interests me, what began in the late 18th century in England was what I call the warfare welfare state. That if you look at all the Western countries today, their money is spent either on war or on welfare. They're mm-hmm. the two things. And that is what we got into, I think, in the 18th century, and we're still in it today.
Is this kind of model instructive for us, Lawrence Stone, as we look at what's going on in Eastern Europe? I mean, just here again, we're recording this conversation in the fall of 1991. I hear stories on the radio about what will the Russian people do with all these military types? What are they going to do to feed them? What are they, these people are used to doing what they do. Now we don't no longer have these monolithic models of mm-hmm. militarism. Is there an analogy at work here at all?
I think the analogy, I would go back to something like the 30 Years' War. It seems to me have a 200,000 or 300,000, maybe a million troops still with their arms, not being paid, not being fed, mm-hmm. housed in tents. Well, they're going to just take to banditry, I think. Or civil war or something. It's absolutely terrifying.
Well, I know that you historians don't like to look into crystal balls, and you don't pretend to be prophets and to tell us what the future holds, but do you, Lawrence Stone, believe in a phrase like the lessons of history? I mean, how do we look back at, for example, the Napoleonic Wars and draw from that experience anything that's instructive about the way we should behave in our military institutions here in the 1990s?
Unfortunately, if you look at the record, we usually draw the wrong conclusions. We look into the past for what we want to find, and we find it there, and we bring it back.
So the lessons are there, but we just don't do the best job of...
We ask the wrong questions, basically. Uh-huh. I mean, the typical example in the last 40 years, for example, has been Munich. Munich is a great bugaboo. Let's never try to play ball with dictators. We're hard line. And let's fight the Cold War to the end and so on. Don't negotiate. And that has been dragged in again and again and again in totally different circumstances, which is, you know, we've done terrible harm, I think.
And what do you think about that? I mean, how do you differ? How do you agree? What do you what does that example teach you?
Well, in retrospect, Munich was a very ambiguous thing. It gave us an extra year to rearm. On the other hand, it sold out Czechoslovakia to Hitler. There's pluses and minuses in it, and it's just staved off war for 1 year, not forever. And that is a lesson which obviously is important. On the other hand, to apply this to every situation is ridiculous. Otherwise, you would end up negotiating with nobody except your friends.
What about the argument, Lawrence Stone, that history, this is essentially a philosophical argument, but the historians and the literary people have appropriated it, some would say productively, others would say not so productively, that all history is local, it's political, it does not. There is no way that you can transcend the boundaries of time and culture to, as it were, learn from the past. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure that people do learn very much from the past, alas. I think that's true. But I think we can learn about the past. That is, the idea there is no truth out there, and it's all meaning, it's all construction, it's all language, that reality is constructed by language, I think is a very dangerous heresy. I think it's wrong, and it leads to grave error.
So I can make of you, I can call you an optimist, as it were, as you look back on a lifetime of reading history and doing history. Here we're into the theological, are we not? I'm asking you to speculate on the future of our future.
Well, I'm a natural optimist. I mean, I see danger signals. I don't like this linguistic turn very much. This has done some good things, but also done some very bad things, particularly messed up the language. The language becomes incomprehensible at times nowadays. And this theory that there is no reality out there, I think, is very heretical. In fact, we've just had a book from a very distinguished Harvard professor, Simon Sharma.
Mm-hmm.
He's written this book. Half of it, he explained to his reader, is done on archival research, and it's true. And the other half is he invents characters, he invents depositions, and it's a mixture of fact and fiction.
Can't we say that he's sort of playing with us, that this is a game?
He is playing with us, but it's a very naughty game, it's a very dangerous game, and it's the ultimate, it had to happen, because this is the way the linguistic turn was pushing.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? Fact and fiction, they're all the same.
Lawrence Stone, I want to thank you for your presence and your participation in the public programs of the National Humanities Center. Thank you very much for your help here on Soundings. It's been a pleasure to have you and Jean here at our center, and I wish you well in your work.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Modern Historical Narrative, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with Edwin Yoder, Jr., the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group. Edwin Yoder's latest book is The Unmaking of a Whig and Other Essays in Self-Definition, published by the Georgetown University Press. Because of his fascination with the writing of history, one of Edwin Yoder's unifying themes is the nature of narrative and the stories through which we reflect on our public and private lives. For example, The Unmaking of a Whig includes a profile of personalities, politics, and judicial propriety on the Supreme Court. In another essay, this one on personal history, Edwin Yoder reflects on his own moral and intellectual development. I asked him to explain the title of his book, The Unmaking of a Whig. Edwin Yoder, Jr.
Well, it has to do with a book, a famous book in historiography by Herbert Butterfield of Cambridge University called The Whig Interpretation of History.
Now, this shaped you, as I understand
Well, it, as I say in this lead piece in the little book, it came to my attention at a very critical period, and that was between my undergraduate career at an American university and my journey to Oxford University. And it was assigned to me as a sort of preliminary reading, and it came, as I describe it, as a sort of revelation, because frankly, having been brought up in the generally progressive political tradition of American history. Everything's getting better and better,
yep,
every day in every way. It suddenly, it wasn't so much that it was an attack on the idea of progress in history, although it is that in part. It was the idea, which was seemed a bit startling to me, that some of the great losers, even some of the great villains in history, might have something to be said for them if you understood the constraints in which they lived and operated.
Well, now, this isn't so much to apologize for them as it is to explain them. We're on the right track?
Yes, that's certainly not to apologize, although you are familiar with the old saying, to understand all is to forgive all. It really isn't about that, although that's a hazard at the extreme of this view of history. In fact, the irony is that Herbert Butterfield was intentionally interested in moral questions in history and moral judgment, but he wrote this book really in response to a famous lecture given by Lord Acton as his inaugural lecture as Regius Professor of History at the University of Cambridge many, many years ago, in which he urged young historians not to be afraid to make extreme and vehement moral judgments on the villains of history as they saw them. And Herbert Butterfield saw this as the very essence of what was called Whig history. In the term means different things to different people. It means a different thing in England, really, than in America, and it means a different thing in the study of history than it does in politics. But in any event, Whig history was judgmental history with the idea of progress at its core.
All right, now that's what you became after a fashion, and what? How long did you stay in this state of Whiggishness, and what converted you?
I think, and maybe I say somewhere in this piece that I think Americans are natural Whigs, in that we really fancy, I mean, our kind of national, one of our national myths is that we took this raw continent and disciplined it, and we are the great exemplars of the idea of progress on the planet and in the whole of recorded historical time.
Yeah, there's a line in Melville or in one of his critics about what he calls fatal American optimism. We have enough of it, but we don't understand really what we're up to with it.
Well, that's certainly a danger. It's a hazard. And as you know, in one of these other pieces in this book, I get into the question of presidents who seem to me to have been almost giddily Whiggish about the possibilities of human striving. So anyway, I think we all come up as Americans as natural Whigs, and so that's how I was unmade by this book, in a sense.
Americans have been accused of being, the short term for it is triumphalist.
Exactly.
We are standing at the apex of history. We're the reason that history exists. What about this?
Well, that is the conceit which lies at the heart of Whiggish, the Whig interpretation of history, according to its critics, anyway. We are, as you say, the apex. We are the perfect realization of all of the things that have been going on all of those times and years past. And the great vice of it, it seems to me, as I reflect on it, is that it encourages us to be patronizing about and condescending to the past, rather than really trying to understand the past in its own terms.
Differentiate for me what you call programmatic politics and what you call institutional politics. Now, you know, after a fashion here, we're still with Whig history, are we not?
Well, in that particular essay, I was really, like many of the pieces in this book, it's sort of quasi-autobiographical in the sense that I sort of review the development of my own thinking about politics and society over the years. What I said was essentially this, that those of us, I was born in the 30s, and I grew up really happily in the in a household where Franklin D. Roosevelt was revered as a very great president, and I still am of that view. I think the impact of the 30s politically in this country was to give us some idea that the essence of politics is programmatic. That is, if there's a problem, you develop a program.
And we go fix it.
And we go fix it. Yeah. The program fixes it, and the program usually means a piece of legislation which we then put some money behind and we go and apply that.
Mm-hmm.
The point I make here is that it seems to me manifest increasingly that so many of our problems today involve the disintegration or dysfunction of institutions, whether you're thinking about the private realm, the realm of the family, or whether you're thinking about the public realm. I mean, just for example, how do we go about developing a system for making coherent decisions about the federal budget? Never mind what substantively those decisions may ultimately be.
Well, we appeal to history. We look at politics institutionally, right?
Well,
we revive our memories.
We should, but what I mean by institutional function is, take, for example, the contrast between budget politics in the United States and budget politics in Britain. As you know, once a year, a British government presents a budget. And if the House of Commons refuses to pass it, the government falls, and you have another election, and you keep doing that until you got a budget. At least there's some specific accountability here. In our case, the president proposes a budget. Congress may or may not pay attention to it. It has only that significance which Congress chooses, because it has full control of the spending power by constitutional direction. What attention and credence Congress chooses to give it. The point is, there's a great dispersion of accountability, and everybody pursues his own purposes, and pretty soon you're in the kind of dilemma we're in over our budget, where in fiscal 1992, we're expecting a deficit of $350 billion or more.
How might institutional politics rescue us or point us in the right direction in contrast, our way out of this situation, in contrast to programmatic politics?
Well, we've got too many, manifestly, have too many programs and weak institutions, in the sense that, for example, again, under the old regime of budget politics in Congress, the House Ways and Means Committee, under people like Wilbur Mills and many very strong predecessors, had a kind of power and authority to say, okay, you will get this much money and you will get that much money, and to keep things under control. That kind of institutional authority, for a great variety of reasons, has disintegrated. And it seems to me that what we need to do is give greater thought to the rejuvenation or strengthening of these institutional functions in our politics. The parties, for example, have fallen completely to pieces. Uh-huh. They are no longer significant players in our national politics.
Well, I know that we could go on at great length accounting for this situation, Ed Yoder, but can we lay it at the door? Do we lay it at the doorstep of the politicians or the citizenry?
Well, if you want to, you know, if blame is your game, you can find plenty of people to blame. But I just don't think it's a very useful or fruitful thing to do. What we need to do is analyze how these things change, how the historical process works in our lives and in our history, and decide what the historical process, what historical change has done to institutions like the family, for example, or like the Congress of the United States, which once were more, seemed to be more functional than they are today. Why have they changed? What is it about the change that may have destroyed their usefulness, not their usefulness, but their ability to grapple with specific problems?
Does the journalist have anything to do with all of this, Ed Yoder? One of your pieces here in The Unmaking of a Whig is you have a piece on the myth of the Fourth Estate. You have a wonderful little story there about Mr. Edmund Burke. What about this?
Well, Edmund Burke was the person who was responsible for flattering those of us who push pencils by saying that we were the fourth estate of the realm.
And more powerful.
And more powerful than all the rest, or something like that.
But, of course, he didn't really mean that.
Well, at the time he said it, as I think I may point out, no one in his maddest flight of imagination could have imagined that there would be a society on the face of the earth where the press would exercise the kind of actual political power which in fact it exercises in the United States, for better or worse. I think for both. Our function really is to be members in good standing of what are called the chattering classes. I mean, what we do while other people are working, we chatter. And sometimes our chatter is constructive and sometimes it's not.
Well, now, a more dignified term might be the interpretive class, the people who stand on the sidelines or, in a way, get involved in the action and help the rest of us to understand what's going on, whether we're talking programmatic or institutional politics. Are you optimistic about the role of the
press? That's a highly idealized and optimistic view of the present function of the press. I myself am worried, frankly, about it. And my worry has a lot to do with a rather violent bias of mine, which is that the American Republic was born in what is sometimes called the linear age, the age of print, government by consent, by informed consent, which is at the heart of our governing system, is the supreme theory of our, goes with popular sovereignty as our, as one of the great axioms of our political system, depends upon the understanding of intricate and complex problems, which in my view can be understood and mediated only by print or printed discourse, or maybe the kind of discourse we're having at these microphones. I'm very disturbed about the impact of television on our politics, because it seems to me that it has made our politics increasingly volatile and impressionistic. Now, I admit to bias, and it may be self-interested.
Oh,
bias,
but
there you are.
I welcome your bias. I mean, you've heard the story about USA Today being nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for the investigative paragraph. That's in a way what we've come to.
Well, I think it was my colleague James Jackson Kilpatrick who first referred to USA Today as Mac Paper.
Right.
But I shouldn't knock it, because I write for it on occasion.
Ed Yoder, your book is The Unmaking of a Whig, Georgetown University Press. It's a pleasure to have you at the Humanities Center. Thanks for your participation on Soundings.
Always delighted to be here, Wayne. Thank you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about modern historical narrative. The speakers were Lawrence Stone of Princeton University and Edwin Yoder, Jr. of the Washington Post Writers Group. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 604. That's program number 604, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, the fourth segment in a series of programs about the emergence of democracy around the globe. Zhang Zhilian of the University of Peking and Eduardo Rabosi of the University of Buenos Aires will discuss the idea of a civil society in contemporary China and Latin America. The idea of a civil society was the subject of a recent conference at the National Humanities Center. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Personal History and Public Narrative, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Historian Lawrence Stone of Princeton University and Edwin Yoder, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, discuss how personal experience and historical themes shape our lives. Historical Narrative, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.